May it please the court, your honors, Mr. Chief Justice, counsel. My name is Jeff Genelotti on behalf of the appellant, Diana Purnell Charleston. Seated with me, your honors, at counsel table is David Denham from my law office. At the outset, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of rebuttal time, if I may.
Yes.
Thank you. Your honors, I'm going to dive right into this. This appeal follows a long line of well-established Delaware case law in the arena of reformation of an automobile insurance contract. The relevant portion of the statute that addresses this is in the uninsured, underinsured motorist context, 18 Delaware Code Section 3902, particularly subsection B of the statute. And I certainly don't intend to rehash the entire contents of appellant's opening brief.
Well, is it fair to say that no one disputes what law applies? But this is a dispute over whether the factual findings made by the trial court are correct and whether the trial judge drew appropriate inferences from those facts?
I think that is true, Your Honor. I think that it's a two-part inquiry, whether the trial court drew the appropriate inferences from the facts, and then the second part of that equation is whether those facts were correctly applied in terms of the law. But I think the law is Section 3902. I think the issue, to clarify the court, is whether or not there was a meaningful offer of insurance made
right.
to my client, Diane.
I think you'll find out that we're familiar with the facts and we're familiar with the law. And if you can tell us precisely how you believe the trial judge got it wrong, it would be helpful.
I think, Your Honor, that the trial judge got it wrong by he erred by relying upon custom and practice testimony of the State Farm agent, Charles Redstone, in this case. And I think where the error is that the trial judge looked at custom and practice testimony, which the lower court conceded custom and practice in and of itself is not sufficient to carry the insurer's burden to establish that it made a meaningful offer. And the court conceded that, as did counsel. What the court did is it then looked at the custom and practice testimony in the context of additional factual findings and factual inferences, to basically apply what I would call a totality of the circumstances approach, which is where I believe the trial court erred, to answer your question. Delaware law is clear that custom and practice testimony in and of itself is not enough in accordance with the Patilla case.
Well, Delaware law touched in the past, didn't it, on a corporate-wide practice. And in this particular case, the court focused on the practice of an individual insurance agent who testified that on this occasion, I did exactly what I do customarily. And the insured couldn't clearly state, no, he didn't. Isn't that the problem here?
I think, Your Honor, the insured stated that, no, he didn't explain uninsured, underinsured to me at any point. The concept of it, the premiums for it, the coverages for it. That was the testimony of my client.
Well,
I think
how does that work in, you know, the custom and practice on this particular issue and what we see in the record on the computer screen? The way I read the record initially, he seemed to suggest, I just don't leave it at the paperwork. I show them the screen, and on the screen we have the rates. And now, at one point I got the impression your client acknowledged looking at a computer screen, but maybe not on a particular day. And then at another point, I got the impression she was trying to say she didn't look at the computer screen, but at the end of the day, the Superior Court concluded that the screen had been shown. So can you help me understand that part of the record?
Sure, Your Honor. I think what my client said in terms of the record, if my recollection and reading of it is correct, is that she did not recall seeing the computer screen. Now, I don't know whether that means, frankly, that she saw it and doesn't remember it, or that she's saying I outright didn't see it, but her testimony was that I don't recall. And I think what the court concluded is that she said exactly that. Ultimately, what the trial court judge said is that I don't believe either side, Mr. Redstone nor the appellant, have any recollection of what happened that day in terms of the specifics of the conversation. And so I think what the lower court did was basically say, I'm going to forget about what the party's recollection or lack thereof is, and that's where the concept of inferences
is. There some uncertainty about the insurance agent testifying that he showed the screen with the rates to the plaintiff?
I think there's uncertainty from the plaintiff's vantage point, yes.
No, I'm not talking about the plaintiff's vantage point, but I thought what you just said suggested that the trial judge couldn't reach a firm conclusion about whether or not the insurance agent put up on the TV screen the rate structure, which would explain what it costs to boost the amount of coverage for underinsured, uninsured, and talk to the plaintiff about that, or there's some uncertainty that that ever happened in the conversation between them. Is that fair?
I don't, my reading of it, Your Honor, is that I think you're right. I think that's fair in the sense that I think the trial judge, in making his factual findings, concluded that the appellant saw, at least with respect to particular coverages, maybe not all, maybe some, maybe not others, saw the computer screen. That was one of the things that if you see in appellant's brief that I believe that the factual findings made by the court are not entirely supported by the factual evidence of record. There were seven factors in the court's analysis that it employed.
Okay, well, that's critical, to, at least to my mind, because the law is pretty clear that putting the form in front of a prospective insured alone is not enough.
I think
there has
right.
to be some explanation of what that form means and what the consequences may be to the prospective insured when they make their selection about the extent of coverage they want for underinsured, uninsured, whether they want to match their BI coverage or whether they don't. So there has to be some factual basis to believe there was an explanation. As I read, and I'm willing to be convinced otherwise, as I read the trial judge's factual findings, he ultimately concluded that there was sufficient uncertainty about the plaintiff's or the prospective insured's recollection, or the insured's, at the end of the day's recollection, and he concluded that there had been an explanation well beyond just presenting the form, and that satisfied him under the totality of the circumstances that there was more to this than just the form, and therefore Delaware law was satisfied that there was a meaningful offer. Am I wrong about that?
My belief, Your Honor, is that he found that the appellant testified that she did not recall any explanation of UM-UIM coverage to her. I think that he found that she did see the computer screen again with regard to some things and not others. What ultimately the issue that was framed by the court was, and as Your Honor points out, the law is clear that the Form A in and of itself is not enough.
Right.
The law is clear that custom and practice is not enough.
Right.
And so the issue that's really framed is if you put the two of them together and you incorporate other inferential, circumstantial speculation and assumption, whether the insurer can get over its burden to establish.
Well, to help me out here, as I read his opinion, at the end of the day, he found that there was a meaningful offer because there was an explanation, though consistent with that individual insurance agent's custom and practice, it nevertheless was an explanation of the consequences of the underinsured, uninsured selection made by this insured, and that at the end of the day, what the insured was really looking for was a lower rate than she had paid before, and this was one of the ways in which she achieved that lower rate. Now, if that indeed is a fair reading of the trial judge's opinion, where was his factual conclusions in error?
Well, I think that there's three factual conclusions, as I pointed out in appellant's brief, that aren't necessarily supported entirely by
that. That's what I want to know.
Okay.
Please.
Just bear with me one moment.
Sure.
The first of the factors, Your Honor, and there's three of them, if I may address them, is factor number five. The court found, and it is noted in the court's opinion, that, and I'm quoting, Ms. Purnell Charleston could not definitively or definitely and reliably state that Mr. Redstone did not make a meaningful offer of UM-UIM coverage to her. That is inconsistent with what the record states and what my client testified to. In fact, she testified that he at no point explained the concept of uninsured, underinsured motorists, the cost, the premiums, what it was for, or the fact that she had the right to carry UM-UIM limits equal to those of her bodily injury liability limits. That's the first, Your Honor. The second factor is number six, as it's outlined in the lower court's opinion, the fact that the court relied upon Ms. Charleston testified that she recalled viewing information on Mr. Redstone's computer screen. She actually never acknowledged that he reviewed insurance coverage and or corresponding rates on his computer. and to the contrary, testified on two occasions that she did not recall viewing the computer screen during the 5/14/2007 meeting in the Hartle Agency office. The last of the factors is factor number seven, which is the concept of making the assumption or inference that she must have understood and elected $15,000 of uninsured motorist coverage because she was looking to save money from her previous policy to lower her premiums.
Can I focus on that
sure.
point in particular? I don't know that much about the premium structure generally, but my limited understanding is that the difference in cost for uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage is very much smaller than the other elements of a typical insurance policy. Is there anything in this record that would show that as opposed to paying $27 a month or $27 a week or whatever it is for the minimal insurance, it would have cost $87 for the same period, or would it have cost $30? I mean, what is the incremental difference, and was that clearly expressed somewhere?
The answer to that, Your Honor, is that it was not clearly expressed.
But
from
do
our
we know what it is?
We do not know in this particular circumstance, given the difference between the $25,000 and the $15,000 as it related to a State Farm policy, what that was in Ms. Purnell Charleston's case. There is some general or oblique testimony from Mr. Redstone that that cost would be a marginal difference in premium between $25,000 and $15,000 in uninsured, underinsured motorists.
Is Form A in the appendix?
It is, Your Honor.
Is the rate structure on the reverse side of Form A?
On the original form, it was. I have the rate structure in the appendix, Your Honor. The agent testified that the rate structure was never shown to the appellant because that is, according to him, not part of his customary practice.
I thought you just said earlier it was on the TV screen.
No, I'm talking about the rate structure that was on the reverse side of the Form A.
Okay, but I thought the substance of that rate structure was what he put up on the screen as consistent with his custom and practice to explain to the insured what the relative cost would be.
I can't answer that, Your Honor, because from our vantage point, we don't know what was on that screen. My client testified she never recalled seeing the screen, and Mr. Redstone, while testifying that he showed her the screen during that meeting, was unable to tell with specificity or particularity what he showed her, in what increments he started.
Okay,
nothing
so
specific
your
about
it. Your position is the record does not reflect that the insurance agent said that the purpose of the showing her the TV screen was to explain the rate structure to her. That's not in the record.
It is in the record that his customary practice was to show the computer screen for the purpose of walking an insured, a potential insured, through the various coverages.
Okay.
I don't know if that
he
answers
said
your question.
He showed her the computer screen in the record, didn't he?
He doesn't remember showing her the computer screen. He testified that it is his custom and practice to use the computer screen in every circumstance when he meets with an insured. My point is he can't definitively establish that in this case, and the burden's on the insurer.
Is it also your position that the trial judge made no such finding or erred by making a finding that that rate structure was shown on the computer screen to Ms. Purnell Charleston?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think he erred, and I think he erred by making a leap that she saw that computer screen when it was not definitively established through the insurer who carries the burden of proof.
Okay.
Did they meet on more than one occasion in person?
They did not, Your Honor, to my knowledge, to my clients.
I'll reread the record. I was under the impression at one point in time your client acknowledged seeing the computer screen but debated when she had seen the screen. But you're telling me if I reread the record, I'm not going to find anywhere where your client ever said she ever saw a computer screen.
I'm telling you, Your Honor, that what she testified is she did not recall seeing a computer screen. Again, how that is to be interpreted, I think that basically the lower court gave no deference to her comment because it ultimately concluded she had no recollection of the meeting nor what happened, nor did Mr. Redstone.
Well, that probably stems from the fact that you asked her, my question is, after a number of other questions, do you think that he did not show it to you? Her answer was, it's possible he didn't. Now, you could infer the moon and the stars from that response. And as I read your questions and answers to her, it brought back a lot of memories from my trial practice. You get what you get, and under some circumstances. But her ultimate conclusion was, it's possible he didn't. And from that, the trial judge rejected her recollection.
I think that's right, Your Honor. He rejected her recollection, and the question becomes, and I would say to the court that I don't necessarily need to know whether one needs to find the plaintiff credible, believable, whether she had a recollection or whether she didn't. What I'm saying is that a matter of Delaware law, that you can't get to the circumstantial evidence, that custom and practice alone isn't enough, Form A alone isn't enough, putting them together isn't enough, and you can't consider circumstantial evidence in sort of an addition-type format, meaning, as I pointed out in the appellant's brief, that the sum of the parts can't be greater than the whole. No one piece of circumstantial evidence is enough for the insurer to carry its burden that there was a meaningful offer. So whether you have seven factors as relied upon by the court, it's our contention that three of them aren't necessarily supported by the record, perhaps four of them are, but whether you have seven factors or 75 factors, in and of themselves, no one of them alone are enough for the appellee to overcome its burden. And it's for that reason that I think upholding the lower court ruling here will effectively erode Delaware case law on that issue. It's going to open floodgates to basically create a fact-specific inquiry in every circumstance where it's an agent's word against an insured's word. Well, I told her this. Well, I told her that. And you bring circumstantial evidence into the mix, and it's going to make every case factually specific. It's going to have to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis.
Is there something unusual about that in the law, that every case is factually specific? And that a general principle of law may be applied differently depending upon the facts?
Not as a general matter, Your Honor, no. I would agree with that. But what I'm saying is that in a case like this, I don't think you have to get to the factual findings. Again, while I think some of them are unsupported, I don't think you have to get to those factual findings. Custom and habit, the reason I would submit to this court, the reason custom and habit in and of itself is insufficient to overcome the burden of making a clear and unequivocal offer?
Let's assume for a second that I agree with you on that. There would have to be a record that's established that the insurance agent said, I don't recall whether I told her anything beyond what was on the form, but it's my custom and habit to sit down with all my insurers and explain their options, what underinsured, uninsured means, and the difference in the rate structure for the various coverages from the minimum to the equality with BI. Is that the case here, that the insurance agent said, all I rely upon is that's what I usually do. I never really did anything directly with this insured.
Well, what he said, and I think that's exactly right, but what he said is, I don't remember any interaction with this insured. I don't remember talking to her. I don't remember meeting with her. But what I can tell you is what I always do. This is what I always do. Well, Your Honor, that's like me saying, an automobile accident happens, and I know I had my left blinker on when I made the turn in front of that vehicle because I always have my left blinker on. At this point, I'm going to sit down, if I may, unless there's any other questions for me. Reserve my time for
rebuttal. Save the rest of your time.
Thank you.
Good morning, members of the court.
If you wouldn't mind, I'd like to start out with what I expressed a concern about before, and I now see that page A64 of the appendix has what I believe is the second side or the back side of Form A.
Yes.
And that has premiums, three sections of premiums, and I guess they vary based upon not only the territory that you live in, but also what level of discount you're getting.
That's true.
Do we know which discount and which territory this person was in so we can actually look at the numbers?
No, Your Honor, and that's why Mr. Redstone used the computer screen. What Your Honor will recall is that State Farm has two companies, State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company and State Farm Fire and Casualty. What you do is you input the basic information about that particular insured into the computer screen, and based upon various factors, and the record doesn't reflect what those factors are, But the record does reflect that based upon the information you put into the screen, the particular company with which you was placed was checked, selected by the computer. So you can't tell a particular from the back of the form, and I know that's why people do not use it. They simply input the information to the screen. The computer screen will tell you what the premiums are, and you can tell that way. So,
okay, well, that, to me, that's somewhat concerning, because what you're saying is that although there's this nice form that says all about, I know I've got choices, and then in the back purports to even show what the different choices are and how much the difference in cost would be, you're telling me that the back of the form really is not what's relied upon by anyone, because you have to put the specifics in and get a specific answer on the computer, right?
Well, I'm not saying it's not relied upon by anybody, but I don't think that it should be concerning to the court, because an individual sits in front of an individual, the individual potential insured and the individual agent. They discuss things with them. Where do you live? What is your age? What is your driving record? Things of that sort. It's imputed into the screen, and based upon that information, there are premiums that are being charged to that individual. If I have a spectacular driving record, I'm going to get a different premium than somebody who says not.
No, I understand all of the variations and the reasons why one person would get a different rate than another. My concern is this. The idea behind this law is that people should know that they can get more coverage if they want. And they should also know how much that additional coverage is going to cost.
Certainly.
Right? Okay.
But the point is that form is not being used to give that information.
Okay, so what we're down to is that the form is essentially something we can ignore. And I don't mean totally ignore, but I mean the form doesn't help you with your burden of proof. That you're relying pretty much entirely on what's on a computer screen that nobody remembers exactly what was on it. Nobody can say, oh yeah, it showed it would be X amount for this level of coverage and Y amount for that. It's just an electronic image that hasn't even been saved. So isn't that a little bit weak in terms of meeting a burden of proof as to what the insured was told?
Not at all, Your Honor. You don't have... There's no requirement, and I've read through all the cases, either for this case or for other cases, because I've been involved ever since the Arms versus State Farm case, because I wrote part of that brief, and I was involved in the Morris versus Allstate case. I don't believe that the court, the Superior Court or this court, has ever gotten itself concerned about whether a premium is one premium or as opposed to another premium. It's never been an issue in any of the cases. The obligation is to tell the insured that they have a right to equal limits of uninsured and liability coverage. The obligation is then, per the Morris case, to tell the insured what the premium is. Once you've told them the premium at a time, and you can prove that you did it since you have the burden of proof, that's the end of the matter. There's no requirement, and there's no case of which I'm aware that ever said that this is the premium and you have to remember what it was. You simply have to explain it at a time. If I go in...
But wait a second. Doesn't the insured have to be told this is the premium at the minimum and this is what the premium would be for the underinsured, uninsured coverage?
Yes.
If you took the higher rate?
Yes.
And those two figures, the only evidence that that information was provided is that there was a computer screen that presumably had that information and that the insured doesn't remember necessarily looking at, but that the insurance agent said, you know, I showed her what's on the screen, and that's that.
Mr. Redstone testified twice, once at page 23, that he understood his obligation to offer the higher limits and to tell him about the difference in the premium. He did that at the Peter Wolf Agency. He testified at page 30 that he did that at the Hartle Agency, that he actually tilted the screen toward the insured. He understood what his obligation was and showed to that insured what the premiums were. This is not a motion for summary judgment where there are factual disputes. This is a trial. And this is one of the few, if not the only case that I can recall of all the cases that were decided by the Superior Court and by this court where it isn't a case of the court interpreting the facts in light of the non-moving party. a judge, a fact finder, heard the evidence and decided that based upon the evidence and the circumstantial evidence and the custom and habit, that he was going to decide in favor of the fact that Mr. Redstone did follow his custom and practice. So the question really is not whether there are factual disputes. There are no factual disputes anymore. The trier of fact made a finding of fact. It is supported by the record based upon what Mr. Redstone said, and it's based upon the case law, and it's based upon circumstantial evidence. As I pointed out in the brief, I think it's civil jury instruction 23.1, the court and the fact finder can decide based upon circumstantial evidence, and the law makes no difference or distinction between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence.
Well, one of the interesting aspects of this case to me is that very fact, that the trial judge has made findings of fact, one of which, as your friend pointed out, is number 7 in his findings, that there's an inference that the insured was looking to save money. And we know from the record that other than property damage, she reduced coverage in every other area available to her, which is, it's a reasonable inference from that circumstance and her employment situation. She was looking to save money. The interesting question about the difference in the premium between the minimum for underinsured and uninsured and the BI coverage in this case is, if she was looking to save money after that was explained to her, how much would she have saved from that difference? In order to reach the conclusion to support the carrier side of this case, that one of the reasons why he ruled the way he did was because she was looking to save money, so she knew what she was doing and she rejected the higher premium. Was it a significant difference or not?
Mr. Redstone testified, and I have the page here for that summary. I think he testified that the difference was $15 to $20. And for that period of time, I think it's 6 months premium. But I think I'm not sure the court's missing the point, but when you're sitting there and looking at an insurance premium and there's 6 different elements to that insurance premium, it isn't that at one point you have a policy that costs $520 every 6 months, you reduce the UM coverage and you have a policy of $500 per month. You keep reducing in incremental amounts. You go from the no-fault coverage from 100 to 25. You reduce the liability from 100 to 25. You reduce the collision coverage from whatever it was to whatever it was, and you keep adding it up. So by the time you add all 6 parts of it together, instead of, and I'm making these figures up, these aren't accurate figures, instead of having a policy of $800 every 6 months, you end up with $500 every 6 months. And that's the way people buy things. You buy anything. We all do that. Even if you're buying a car, you don't necessarily say, this is what I want. You keep adding or subtracting the options based upon where you expect to end up.
Well, maybe we, or the court, or I am missing the point, as you pointed out. It seems to me that if someone were to sit down with a prospective insured and say, I know you're looking to save money, here's where you're really going to save the money, but do you understand that you can provide for yourself protection from an underinsured or an uninsured motorist up to the extent you provide BI coverage to someone else, and it will only cost you $20 more a policy period? Do you really want to keep it at the bare minimum just to save $20 when you can save $300 by raising your deductible for collision damage, or save $400 by cutting your BI coverage? I think that's what the law wants the insurance agent to explain to people. And it may be rash, but I don't think I'm missing the point on that.
No, Your Honor, I didn't mean to imply you're missing the overall point. What I'm pointing out is this. The statute itself simply says you must offer the insured the higher limits of UM coverage to equal the liability coverage. That's all the statute says. The court in arms said, wait a second here. You must make an affirmative offer, and if you haven't made such an offer, then it's a continuing offer. The court in the Morris case added another twist to it, saying, well, it has to be a meaningful offer, and the meaningful offer includes the cost of the coverage. Most of the cases since Morris have nothing to do with what we're talking about here today. a number of the cases cited by the appellant in the decision in the brief are the USAA progressive cases where there is an offer based upon a writing. So a third element was added, that it must be an offer in equal opportunity. There are a number of cases talking about when do you make the offer. It may be based upon a material change in the policy, such as an insured being changed or a particular type of car being added. Basically, we're going back to the Morris case. I mean, the Morris case is not the end of the decision-making process for this court, but it is the point of reference, I think, that this court has to take, which is if an insurer, in this case Mr. Redstone, goes to the coverages and he testified in his deposition, he started at 100 and worked his way down, and then he did what he was obligated to do by turning that computer screen to the insured and saying, this is what you're going to get and this is what it'll cost you. It's what it's going to get and it'll cost you for the additional coverage, which is what he said at page 30 of the transcript.
Is there anywhere in the record that you know of where she acknowledged seeing the screen in her deposition or at trial?
I can simply refer to what Chief Justice said a few moments ago at page 53. There was a colloquy between Mr. Genlotti and I think it was either Mr. Gendelheim or myself, I can't remember, about that. There were four or five questions. Did you see the screen? I don't remember. Does that mean that you didn't see it? I don't remember. Does that mean that you say you didn't see it or did see it? And basically she kept saying, I don't remember. And then she said that in the question that was just asked by Chief Justice Steele about, well, by the time she got to the end of the colloquy was, he may not have shown it to me, which is not the same thing as saying he didn't. And my point is, of course, that since Mr. Redstone's entire practice was based upon looking at the premiums on the screen and turning it to the insured, that's what he would have done. Why would he have done something else?
So going back to the way you characterize the record, in your exchange with Justice Berger, there's no way he communicated the premium to anybody except by showing them the screen.
Yeah, and showing them the screen and pointing out the differences in the coverages.
But to the extent you were going to be buying insurance from him, you were going to find out the price based on him showing you the screen. That was his custom and practice.
Yes.
And so his testimony was, that's the only way I do it, so I'm sure I did it here.
Yes. I mean, there was no reason for him to do anything else because, as he said, and he did say in his testimony, it was so easy to show the screen because you could show different screens and you could show two screens at a time is what he said. And since you could show two screens at a time, the insured could be looking at the original quote for whatever they were purchasing and the quote for the additional coverage. It was just so easy to use.
Well, your own description of it, at least from my perspective, makes it sound a little bit confusing because there are, what, six different elements of coverage, each with their own premium associated with them, and then a total. and any or all of them can be changing. You can increase your deductible, decrease your deductible, increase your HIP protection, decrease it, whatever. So you can see screen after screen after screen with different numbers on them based upon varying one or more of the multiple elements of a policy. But how do we take from that any kind of meaningful presentation of when you get to the end of the road and you've made all your other selections, so we know what you want for all those other items, here's what's left, which is your uninsured motorist coverage. It will either be a total package of $350 for 6 months, or if you want the additional coverage, it'll be a total package of $365 for 6 months. Isn't that what the statute is trying to accomplish in terms of giving people a meaningful understanding of what they can buy?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The case law of this court is that when you explain the coverages, you must explain it with the equal force and equal clarity that you explain the other coverages. As Your Honor asked the question, If you go through all of the coverage and you explain them, and you explain the UM coverage the same way, and you've given them the opportunity to purchase the coverage in the way the statute requires, that is exactly what meaningful entails. It isn't that you say, I'm going to offer 1, 2, 3, and 4, and 5, and let me stop at 6, the UM coverage, and I want you to put them aside. I'm going to give you a better explanation of that coverage than any other. The statute and the case law that this court has enunciated provides exactly what Your Honor has said. You do it in the same opportunity, not a better opportunity or not a different explanation, but the same opportunity.
Is there any business incentive for an agent as opposed to the carrier itself? Not to sell the highest possible coverage for the highest possible premium in every instance?
Sure. There's always an incentive. If Your Honor is asking, is the business incentive to always sell the highest limits that you can? Is that the question?
Yes.
The answer is, of course there is. You want to sell the best you can because they get the best coverage, but you get the premium. They're in the business of selling insurance. And part of that business is to sell the highest premium they can so that they can make money themselves. What Mr. Redstone said was he always starts at 100, and then he works his way down based upon what they say they want. So there's no incentive for him to sell low coverage. It's just none at all. And one point I want to make is that I called both Mr. Redstone and the plaintiff as witnesses as part of my case in chief. It may have been State Farm's burden of proof, but I think Mr. Genlotti seems to be assuming that I have to do that based upon Mr. Redstone alone. And the reason that I called the plaintiff is because I knew by the time we got to that trial that her credibility was at issue. And part of the credibility, and it happens over and over again, not just in the context of these cases, but pretty much every case, is that when a witness who tries to prove a point concentrates on something, they only concentrate on the point they think they want to make, and they seem to forget everything around it. In this particular case, there is testimony from the plaintiff, I think it's at page 65, but it's around that point, that every single premium, the no-fault coverage, the property coverage, the liability coverage, was explained to her by Mr. Redstone. She testified to that. But then when it came to the UM coverage, she denies ever being discussed at all. Not just the premium, but the concept of even offering UM coverage. So on the credibility issue, why would a finder of fact, having heard that from Mr. Redstone that he explained all the coverages, because that's what he did, and having heard that the plaintiff said, yes, every particular coverage and every particular premium was explained to me, why would a finder of fact find that witness to be credible when it comes to the one coverage at issue in this case, and it never came up at all? And that was the reason that I called her as a witness. I wanted the judge to get all the evidence.
Well, wasn't there another credibility problem with the fact that she indicated she wanted the same coverage, but when her prior coverage was put into evidence, it turned out she really bought less coverage?
Yes, and there was twice in the transcript, and I'd have to find it in a second, but there's twice in the transcript where she acknowledged in response to questions from me that she did not give Mr. Redstone a declarations page from AAA, and it was not part of the Hartle agency file, and she said that I did not tell him what the other coverages were. So while she has testified that I wanted good coverage and I wanted equal coverage, the only two people who could have known were she and Mr. Redstone, and she said twice in the record she never told him. Now, there's no obligation of Mr. Redstone or State Farm to sell a person the same coverage they had. Their only obligation is to listen to them, offer them the coverage, and based upon 3902B, to do what they have to do with regard to the UM coverage.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If I may, and fairly quickly, a couple points I want to make. First of all, with regard to the credibility issue, regardless of the inference from the court, whether they found certain things to be credible and made its factual findings, that does not entitle the lower court to misapply the law, and I think I've talked about that. With regard to the election of a lower premium, I would submit to the court that if you assume that she was looking to save money on premium, she would have still been doing it even if she had equivalent bodily injury liability limits and underinsured motorists, which would have come from 100, 300 with AAA, down to 2550. In terms, Your Honor, of your question with regard to whether it was explained to her the difference in the premium and whether it was marginal for UM. That was never explained to the appellant. And again, all we heard was custom and practice. But on page 31, there were some hypothetical questions asked what the difference would be between, say, 15 to 30 and 25, 50. And he says, I'm assuming $15 to $20 more. But there's no definitive answer to what it would be. And I suggest that that wasn't explained to the appellant. The reality of it is, and again, Your Honor, you raised the question, nobody knows what was on that screen, do we? The answer to that is no. And I'll take it a step further and say we'll never know what was on that screen. But it's easy for us to know what's on that screen in today's day and age with technology. As I point out in the brief, it could have easily been printed and signed as an appendix placed in the file. They could have had an electronic type of device where you sign your name like you do with a credit card machine and print out so that we could go back and see through archives or see through a printout what was shown to her. And I suggest that without being able to do that, the appellee cannot sustain its burden of proof.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement for assessment.